Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Kathy Hochul opened the New York State Fair on Wednesday this week with a message to President Donald Trump. Back off with the tariff policy that is hurting New York farmers and ruining relations between Americans and Canadians. The New York Public News Network's Ellen Abbott with more.
Trump tariffs are touching the entire agriculture spectrum in New York State. That, along with poor relations between the U.S. and Canada, has grape growers like Scott Osborne, co-owner of Fox Run Vineyards, losing tourism dollars from Canadians.
The economic impact of that is huge. And, you know, they'll buy my wines in my cafe, or they'll buy the wines while they're staying.
Brian Reeves grows fruits and vegetables in Onondaga County. He says the cost of equipment made in Canada has skyrocketed, with suppliers not sure what's happening next.
They shake their head and say, well, today, here's what the price is, but I can't quote you a month ahead, or I don't know.
Apple farmer Jim Bittner owns an orchard in Niagara County and says the uncertainty means he doesn't know whether to plant fruit trees on 100 acres of empty land, complaining that there's just no certainty what's going on next year or the year after that as far as trade goes.
About 30% of all the apples grown in the United States need to be exported. We don't consume them here. And our two biggest customers is Canada and Mexico. And to get into a squabble with the two of them doesn't do us any good.
Hochul says these are the stories that have frustrated her with the Trump administration, and the reason New York State has come up with a tariff relief fund.
You can only invest in the short term, not the long term, because you don't know what the world's going to bring, especially with these tariffs that have just started in the last couple of years, right?
And the uncertainty is just nerve-wracking.
Hochul expects those funds to be released to farmers this fall. At the New York State Fair in Syracuse, Ellen Abbott for the New York Public News Network.
A New York State law now bars police agencies from maintaining 287G cooperation agreements with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Most counties with those agreements have already agreed to comply, but there's at least one holdout. The Legislative Gazette's Grant Ashley with that story.
Rensselaer County officials say they will be suing the state and federal court to keep their 287G agreement with ICE in place. The lawsuit was not available on the U.S. court system's online document database as of Tuesday afternoon, but officials say it will be filed imminently. The court system's FAQ page says newly filed cases typically appear within 24 hours. The Rensselaer County Sheriff's Office's 287G agreement allows deputies to identify immigrants in the county jail and initiate immigration proceedings against them on behalf of ICE. The county has initiated deportation proceedings against 9 immigrants under the program since it signed the agreement in 2018. County officials say they receive no money from the federal government to participate in the program. 287G agreements in other parts of New York allowed officers to make immigration-related arrests, to serve and execute immigration warrants on those in their custody, or both. Rensselaer County Sheriff Kyle Borgalt said at a press conference Tuesday that he'll be a plaintiff in the case. He says sheriffs should be free to make decisions about 287G agreements locally, but he argues that the state law doesn't recognize Rensselaer County's agreement was different from others in the state.
Our deputies are not out driving around looking for undocumented immigrants. They are not conducting immigration checkpoints. They are not making immigration-related traffic stops. They are not riding around our communities with ICE agents looking for people to arrest. Our participation occurs inside the Rensselaer County Jail, and let me say it again, involving individuals who have already been arrested and brought into our facility.
Individuals held in county jails have been charged with a crime, but they haven't necessarily been convicted. Borgalt and Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin have for months said they planned to ignore the state law, even after the state attorney general's office ordered them to comply in July. They've argued the 287G agreement allows them to keep communities safer by helping them to identify and quickly deport immigrants in the county jail who might be violent criminals.
We'll see you in court, Governor. Because the governor and the AG actions, because of their action, we're not left feeling safer. Instead, we're asking, who's next? In Rensselaer County, we don't stand for it. And as I always say, leaders lead. We want to keep our people safe. We want to keep this community safe. We're doing the right thing.
Governor Kathy Hochul signed the Local Cops, Local Crimes Act into law in May. She says the law ensures that local police departments and sheriff's offices are focused on solving violent crimes and not wasting resources on civil immigration enforcement. Hochul didn't mention Rensselaer County by name, but she had a stern message for any law enforcement agencies that maintained 287G agreements.
Let me be clear. Any police department or sheriff's office that disobeys this law, that maintains any agreement with ICE, will face legal action. And to those suing us, those trying to block the implementation of this law, tried before and failed. Our law has been already upheld by courts. But if you're trying it again, I say bring it on.
Hochul was referring to an ongoing lawsuit brought by the federal government against New York State to overturn the Local Cops, Local Crimes Act. A federal court judge in that case allowed New York to continue enforcing its ban on 287G agreements while litigation continues, citing a similar ban on the agreements in New Jersey that was allowed to stand. The judge in the New York case agreed to temporarily block New York's ban on ICE agents wearing masks. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Grant Ashley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Blair Horner, senior policy advisor for NYPIR, the New York Public Interest Research Group, to talk about the data center moratorium.
For the listeners, the type of data centers we're talking about are the big ones that are moving in to really generate the computing power for AI and some of these other big high-tech activities. And these data centers, New York has a bunch already, so it's not like we don't have any. But really, the sort of ground zero has been Northern Virginia, where these data centers exist. And they have an enormous impact on residential utility rates, electricity rates, because they use up so much power. They also have an impact on drinking water, on water supplies, because they use up a lot of water to cool the thousands of computers that are inside these gigantic facilities. And they also generate noise. There are people in Northern Virginia who've commented that there's a constant hum and their houses vibrate depending how close they are. So as these bigger data centers move into New York, because New York has one of the key things that a lot of the rest of the country is increasingly losing, which is access to water supplies, the moratorium idea was, why don't we just wait a year or so and figure out how we're going to handle this so that, one, electric utility ratepayers don't pay more than they do already, which is already high in New York. Two, that they're not designing the system to divert energy away from the existing grid to these data centers, which effectively raise the rates. And then three, that we're looking at the impacts on drinking water supplies and noise. And so the headlong rush to build them, which is really being pushed by these giant tech companies, has profound impacts on the communities and the areas in which they get built. And so New York's regulatory structure is not set up for these things. And so the idea of the moratorium is to deal with that. Now, the governor has issued an executive order, effectively putting in place a moratorium for a year starting in when she signed the executive order, which I think was in July. The legislation that passed both houses is similar to what the governor wanted, but covers more data centers.
It's a little bit stricter.
It's stricter in terms of the regulatory side, but it covers more data centers because the size of the data center can be smaller to be covered under the legislation.
20 meg.
That's right. And the governor's executive order is 50. So we think the governor did the right thing. She should also then do the right thing and sign the legislation so that New Yorkers, ratepayers, and the environment is protected.
How does that, Blair, jive with how she's handled the climate law, in which she's garnered delays in implementing the climate goals of the state?
This really is infuriating because back in 2019, I think it was, Governor Andrew Cuomo brings in former Vice President Al Gore, who's been on a crusade about climate change, to sign a new law into effect that set standards, benchmarks, for New York State reaching a goal by the middle of this century of net zero carbon emissions in response to climate change, because climate change is primarily driven by the burning of fossil fuels, oil, coal, gas. And then nothing happens, right? So the reports come out, the state comptroller says the permitting process is too slow, outside groups review what state agencies are doing, they're not really issuing orders or anything consistent with the law, COVID doesn't help. And fast forward to 7 years later, Governor Hochul comes in and says, we can't meet these goals because they're too strong. That's not true. Europe is meeting these similar goals.
And she had her agency, NYSERDA, put out a report saying so.
It's not even a report. It was a two-page document that they never really ever justified where they came up with the numbers from. And the proposal was never put in writing. The governor wrote an op-ed for one of the online news outlets. Yeah. That was it. And so not only was it bad public policy, in our opinion, to deal with the climate law by weakening it, but the process by which the law was changed was terrible. There was never a proposal advanced to the public. Everything was done after the public hearing process on the budget had occurred, and it was completely hammered out behind closed doors with no real meaningful public input. And so it was terrible in terms of the climate generally. The state could have met the goals if they had tried, and they didn't try hard enough. And the process by which the law was changed was terrible. So we think it's bad. Now, the governor and the legislature, when they finally cobbled together a deal, did leave in place the mid-century goal of net zero by the year 2050. But the reason why you had these interim goals to get there is because government, like all humans, puts everything off to the last minute. And when it comes to changing your economy from one based on power from fossil fuels versus power from renewables, you can't do it at the last minute. So we'll see if the governor's new sort of paradigm for how to get there works.
That's Blair Horner, senior policy advisor for NYPIRG. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Treated sewage sludge, or biosolids, on farmland has been a big issue in recent years. It's risen to the attention of the New York State Senate, which has advanced a bill that would put a five-year pause on new biosolid processing applications. Proponents argue biosolids supply essential nutrients to crops while adding organic matter to soil and diverting the sludge from landfills. Opponents warn of the accumulation of harmful heavy metals and potential exposure to PFAS chemicals, which have been linked to several ill health effects, including cancer. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine spoke with Galassia Grassetto, the director of a new documentary called The Sludge War.
Yeah, so I moved into what I thought was a very safe neighborhood in California. It was suburban and everything, you know, looked fine on the surface. And at night, there was a smell that came in that was really suffocating, and I couldn't figure out where it was coming from, what it was. And about a year in of just researching, like, what could be happening in this community, I found an article, and it said that sewage sludge had been spread in the community. And, like, I felt like my life was turned upside down, really. And I was shocked to hear that. And so I had never heard of that term before, and that started this five-year investigation into sludge.
So, like you just said, this documentary has been 5 years in the making. That's quite, you know, a long time. How has the public perception of sewage sludge, you know, biosolids, changed over that 5 years in the process of making this film?
Oh, that is such a great question. It has changed so much. So when I first started, my community had really been silenced and told that, you know, this stuff is safe, and you're misguided if you believe that it's not, if you believe that it's unsafe. So I came from the safe really being the status quo, which was the EPA's position, the government's position, basically anywhere you looked, that was the narrative. And so just on a logical level, I felt like, how could this be safe, right? It's industrial waste, hospital waste. And so I really set out on a journey to figure out, is it safe or is it not safe? And that's really the first kind of half of the investigation. Since then, the state of Maine became, well, the first state in U.S. history to ban sludge, which was huge. You know, there's been a lot of local bans in New York, moratoriums in Albany. And so, and now I know the state is trying to push for a 5-year moratorium. So it's changed a lot. It's been in the news. And so there's a lot more support for communities that are affected by this to say, look, hey, this has been covered in the New York Times. This has been covered in the Guardian. Whereas, you know, it wasn't the same when I started.
You know, right here in Saratoga County, just up the road in Moreau, we, in the past couple of years, had a sewage sludge treatment plant proposed and since nixed. It would produce biosolids for farmlands. What kind of success stories, if any, have you seen over the past 5 years of putting this film together?
You know, this has been going on for 40 years, trying to fight this. And there are success stories. I feel like if people come together and really fight it and organize, there's, you can stop it from coming into your community. And I've been to communities that have done that. I mean, and look at Maine, right? But it's difficult when a company is already in a community to get them out. And from my research, I've seen that, like in a newspaper, they'll put nutrient storage facility or tree farm, but it's actually this like massive sewage sludge, like toxic lagoon, but you're saying it's a nutrient storage facility. So somebody that doesn't know, they're not going to go and say like, oh, they're not going to second guess it. And so, yeah, it's just really, it's tough. The language that is used, it's like super greenwashed and, so yeah, but the film shows that other countries have come up with different solutions and they don't land spread. Like Switzerland banned land spreading in 2003. And their environmental protection agency basically said like this stuff is dangerous. It contains all these heavy metals, toxic chemicals. And so there are solutions out there. We just need to prioritize public health and protect our land and our water.
You know, for you, again, over the past 5 years of getting this film done, what's been the largest takeaway for you?
I think the biggest thing is awareness. In the documentary, you'll see that it's been intentionally hidden from the public through internal memos and government documents. And so I think most Americans are still not aware that this happens and that people can send their kids to school and they'll play on it in a football field or even a professional stadium, bring it into their homes as organic compost that you can buy at a store. And so what I would really like to see in this next year is massive awareness so that everybody can have a choice when it comes to like, what are you bringing into your home? Like what affects my health? I really believe in that. And then I think that there needs to be a total ban on sludge nationwide. At least it should not be spread where we grow our food or in our gardens and our schools. So we need to start looking at what can, you know, solutions. And basically, I think our government needs to acknowledge that there is a problem because they haven't really come forward and said, hey, this is an issue, and said we need to do something different.
The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine with Galassia Grassetto, the director of a new documentary called The Sludge War. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A man wants to test howitzer cannons in the Adirondacks, But amid some public outcry, the permit application is stuck in legal limbo. The New York Public News Network's Pat Bradley reports on why the applicant himself and environmental groups in opposition to the Lewis County howitzer testing site agree on the need to stop a legal hearing, just not on the reason for doing so.
The foundation was set up to be totally independent of the company, and it cannot be controlled by the company. And I think that's probably why Magnum is trying to abolish it. What they're doing is illegal, and you know, they're looking for excuses. So they insisted on this special audit. You know, the foundation conducts an independent audit on its own every year, but they wanted their own special one. And the foundation agreed to it on the condition that they share the results of the audit. They share the audit with the foundation. So Magnum has said the audit shows the irregularities. And if that's the case, let's see it. They refused to share it. The foundation has done nothing illegal, has done nothing unethical.
Ben, the foundation had to vacate its offices this week. The release from the foundation said it was planning to suspend operations at the end of the year if the lawsuit doesn't work out properly. But Magnum then ordered that it vacate its corporate offices this week. So how are operations going to work? Are they going to be in limbo between now and the end of the year? What's going to be happening?
I'm not really clear on how the foundation is going to continue to do its work, but I am really clear that this is just a systematic effort to rid Ben & Jerry's of the values that built the company for the last half century. As soon as they became the owner, first they fired the CEO, who was a 30-year employee who worked himself all the way up from tour guide. Then they dismantled the entire independent board of directors, totally illegal. And now they're getting rid of the foundation, also totally illegal. What made Ben & Jerry's into what it is today is a social mission and an independent board that is the guardians of the flame, the guardians of the spirit and the soul of the company. And I'm working to get the company owned by socially aligned investors.
Ben, when we take a look at the social justice mission that you and Jerry and other folks at the foundation have been supporting for so long, has this whole controversy already affected that work? And how much does it worry you in the future that some of these social justice efforts could go by the wayside?
I'm very worried about the social justice efforts going by the wayside. You know, Ben & Jerry's has been in the forefront of the movement for socially conscious businesses. You know, stripping Ben & Jerry's of its heart and its values is a real setback for that whole movement. You know, Ben & Jerry's can go on to continue to fight for justice if we're able to free it from the claws and jaws of the Magnum monster.
Ben Cohen, when we look at the foundation, how much funding that it distributes is at risk?
Well, I believe that it has distributed about $40 million over its lifetime. You know, the amount of money that it gets each year is related to how much ice cream gets sold. So I think that it gets about $7 million a year that it then has been granting to small grassroots advocacy groups that are working for racial justice or economic justice against job discrimination, trying to help immigrants. That's what it's been doing. And the beautiful thing about the foundation is that it funds small organizations kind of before they're able to get funding from other foundations. And then once they get the funding from Ben & Jerry's, they have more credibility, and then they're able to get other donations and grow.
Ben Cohen, if you thought it would be necessary, would you found a new foundation to continue the work?
I think that Ben & Jerry's is a phenomenon. It took 50 years to build it. There's nothing that could replace the Ben & Jerry's Foundation or the social mission of Ben & Jerry's, the company.
In an email to WAMC, Magnum Ice Cream says it is, quote, deeply disappointed to read the press release from the Ben & Jerry's Foundation trustees regarding the foundation, an organization which has to date received $60 million from Unilever, the Magnum Ice Cream Company. The decision to suspend operations is entirely down to the trustees and their decision to ignore the findings of an independent audit and failure to put in place basic good governance, much to our dismay, unquote. Magnum adds that the foundation, quote, mischaracterizes events past and present, unquote, and disputes many of the claims offered by Cohen and foundation trustees. A Magnum spokesman notes that the independent audit had been agreed to and a summary of results were provided to the foundation's president. Quote, the findings found clear conflicts of interest and a lack of governance and financial controls, with the foundation making grants to organizations where board trustees held senior positions and even received compensation, unquote. Magnum also rebuffs claims that foundation staff are totally independent and, quote, not Ben & Jerry's employees, despite utilizing Ben & Jerry's offices and systems, unquote. As for Cohen's hopes to buy back the ice cream company, Magnum states, quote, Ben & Jerry's is not for sale and is thriving as part of the Magnum Ice Cream Company, unquote.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.